Hi there, I'm Mitch Lawrence. Hopefully by now you've had a chance to listen to my Talking Golf Getaways podcast partner Darren Bunch and I talk golf and travel here on Golf News Net. But today I want to share something pretty special with you from a show I did before Darren and I started doing our show. Last week we said goodbye to World Golf Hall of Fame member and five-time Open Championship winner Peter Thomson at age 88. The interview you're about to hear was done in 2014. When I had a show called Golf Connections that was produced by my good friend Jeff Gilder here in Myrtle Beach and ran on Jeff's fantastic platform at thegolfdirector.com, now iNet Golf. If you'll indulge me, I want to give you a quick hit on how I came to interview the great Peter Thomson because I think it says so much about who he was. In 2013, I was sitting around with Jeff sipping some single malt, which we often did. He had a great lineup of shows on thegolfdirector.com, but nothing that dealt with history and tradition of the game. And I had become a hickory-only player. I was telling him about that. He got a twinkle in his eye and said, "I think you should do a show about that." And so I did. It was called Hooked on Hickories. It lasted about a year, and I had a great lineup of guests, thanks to my old acting career, in which I had played in a lot of pro-ams and charity events around the country, and had great relationships with some wonderful people in the game. In 2014, I changed the show, called it Golf Connections, to include a wider variety of guests. And when it came time for the Masters of 2014, I decided to do a whole month of shows just about the Masters. And I'd built up some really great guests around the Masters. I did the same for the U.S. Open. And then it came time for the Open Championship in 2014, which was played at Royal Liverpool. And as I was searching through some guests, and I had some great ones, it occurred to me that there was one person who I could talk to and get a really deep understanding of the Open Championship at Hoylake. That person, of course, Peter Thomson, who in 1956 won at Royal Liverpool, part of a three-year run, consecutive Open Championships that Peter Thomson won, 54, 55, 56, again in 58, again in 65, five times the Open Championship winner. So I thought to myself, what do I have to lose? All Peter Thomson can do is not get back to me or say no. And so I reached out to the PGA of Australia. And the reason that was important was because Peter Thomson, for 32 years of his life, was the president of the PGA of Australia, in addition to this astounding career. And I thought, if anyone can get me in touch with them, it will be them. Of course, there was a couple of challenges. One, Peter Thomson now in his 80s. The second, he had no idea who I was or why I'd want him on my show. So we sent emails back and forth a few times, and somehow, miraculously, they put me in touch with Peter Thomson, who then agreed to come on Golf Connections during Open Championship Month. I couldn't possibly begin to explain not only what his acceptance meant to me, or how quickly I became aware of how true everything was that I'd heard and read about Mr. Thomson. Gracious, kind, incredibly passionate still about the game we all love, full of remembrances about one of the most amazing careers put together by any player in history, and happy to share it all. And so when Peter Thomson passed away last week, the game lost a true link, not only to greatness, but to the spirit and the history of the game. We know he's enshrined in the World Golf Hall of Fame. His legacy is assured, and hopefully it'll be carried forward through podcasts like this, wonderful articles, and all the things that we can do to keep his spirit alive. I'm really happy to share this special episode of Golf Connections with you in honor of Mr. Thomson, in honor of the Open Championship. I hope you enjoy it. It would be impossible for you, really, to experience the joy I had in recording it. Since we'll be talking to Peter Thomson in a moment, a quick history lesson relative to Open champions from Australia, I thought it would be a good idea to connect all of you to that amazing statistic. There have been only four, incredibly. The first Open, of course, in 1860, and almost 100 years later, our guest, Mr. Peter Thomson, was the first Australian to win the Open, and in a bit of a statement, I dare say, he said, "I might be the first, but I'm going to win it three consecutive times, 1954, 5, and 6. as he was the only player in the 20th century to have three consecutive wins. He had two more in 1958 and 1965 for a total of five. In 1960, the great Kel Nagel won at St. Andrews. 21 years after Peter Thompson won in 65, of course, Greg Norman won in 1986 at Turnberry in Scotland. In 1991, Ian Baker Finch at Royal Birkdale. And in 1993, Greg Norman for the second time at Royal St. George's in Sandwich in England. And you get an idea just from that one list about how special the career of Peter Thompson was, a prolific champion on a worldwide scale with victories in his home country of Australia and New Zealand, all over Europe, Asia, the United States. Many, many, many wins worldwide, including the PGA Tour, the Australasian Tour, the European Tour, the Champions Tour, where he won nine tournaments in 1985 in an incredibly consistent career. The winner of seven major championships over more than three decades, including the Senior PGA Championship in 84, the Senior British in 88, the year of his induction into the World Golf Hall of Fame, three times the President's Cup captain, and as I said, one of the truly great members of the World Golf Hall of Fame. And I can really say without hesitation that it's an honor and a privilege to welcome Mr. Peter Thompson to Golf Connections here for Open Championship Month as he joins me from Australia. Peter, good morning in Australia. Good evening here in Myrtle Beach.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning. I've been to Myrtle Beach the years gone by. I've been nearly everywhere years gone by.
It's probably changed a little. I'm not sure when you were here last time, but there's a whole lot of golf.
Oh, eons ago. Eons. Yeah. Here is an eon.
Yeah, it's a fabulous place, and hopefully one day maybe we can welcome you back. As we get started in this discussion of Open Championships, and I don't think there's anybody better or more qualified to give us a peek inside the Open, but if we can go back before that to your career in terms of golf, you started in the Melbourne area at Royal Park. And from what I read, it was kind of a nine-hole golf course and maybe on the sly a little bit. You got out and started to play at Royal Park. Is that right?
Well, that's true and honest, because I lived right opposite the nine-hole course, which was a public facility. And it was a great attraction. I couldn't bring myself to ignore it, so I had to play golf.
And you started playing, and then fairly early, you took to the game, obviously, really well. And by the age of 15, you were the club champion. I think the members kind of saw something in you and said, come on and play. And by 15, you were already club champion. Go ahead.
Yes, well, a lot of people were keen to help me, and they did, and they got a result for their help. Anyway, I also found out that playing golf was going to be better than working.
An early hint at the intellect of Peter Thompson.
My career went chasing a golf ball.
Uh-huh. And then a couple of years as an assistant pro in a pretty famous area now, especially worldwide. We've gotten to hear a little bit about the Melbourne Sandbelt and the great, great courses that are there. What was those couple of years like as far as actually working at a club and getting your feet wet in that side of the game?
Well, that was a PGA requirement to be a professional golfer. You had to do an apprenticeship with one of the members. And those 2 years were spent really doing nothing except waiting for them to end. But they did end, and I was very grateful for the joining the PGA, and for 32 years I was the president of the PGA eventually.
That's an amazing statistic to me. We can talk about that a little bit later on, but from the time you jumped in and turned pro after your assistant job, you pretty much dominated Australian golf. Everything that I read, everything was just about how quickly the name became Peter Thompson. Would you say that playing and growing up on those kind of courses, I'm not sure how early you got to Royal Melbourne and some of the other amazing golf courses that we know about now, did that really prepare you, do you think, for the kind of success that you would experience worldwide?
Well, probably to some extent anyway. I'll concede that they were great training tracks for me and any other of the younger brigade. They were very hospitable. I played on most of the courses when I chose to. That goes for, I suppose, all the clubs. They were always very helpful to a young man coming up. And so that's what happened to me. But I must say that it wasn't always the play on the sand belt courses, as we call them. There are other nice courses inland and all over Australia. Matter of fact, I suppose Australia, you can say, is very rich in golf courses.
I would absolutely say that. And so you started playing all over. You start playing professionally and obviously make a big impact right away. And then early, as a youngster, if I'm correct, you were not yet 22 years old. We could, as I said before we started the interview to you, we could spend so much time on various stages of your career. But because this is Open Championship Month, I think what I would like to kind of connect the listeners to is the great career you had in the Open at not quite 22 years of age in 1951. I believe your first Open Championship at Royal Portrush, which we're all connected to once again as they've been included now in the Rota again. But in 1951, at a pretty tender young age, you travel a great distance to play in the Open. You have a magnificent finish that year. I don't know that anybody's ever had a better start in Open Championship competition than you did between 1951 and 1958. I was looking around. I couldn't find anybody. But you tied for sixth at that first Open. What was, if you can give us a little insight into that first experience of traveling all that way and then competing at Royal Portrush?
Well, I don't remember every item of it. It was a lot of fun, I found, playing in the Open Championship. I was keen to come back again and give it another try the following year, and that eventually led to a winning score. But Portrush was a lovely course, and I enjoyed every minute of my time there.
Mm-hmm. And in 1952, you keep going, and again, to me, kind of a statement. You finished second, the great, great South African Bobby Locke.
Yes.
By a shot at Royal Lytham.
Correct. I played with him, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that, go ahead.
No, well, he was very kind to me, very friendly, and because he's a much older man.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed his example he set for me, and it came off in a couple of years later.
Right, and then in 53, of course, Ben Hogan's great win at Carnoustie. He won that tournament by four, but again you finished in a tie for second. Were you feeling after these first three Opens like you had found, not that you hadn't before, but that you had found a stage? Clearly, you liked that atmosphere and the feeling of playing that kind of golf, the style of golf.
Yeah.
Did you instantly connect to it?
Oh, well, I think I can say yes. I set my sights on the Open every year from there on. Sometimes people say, how did you win five Opens? Well, the fact is that I lost 25. I played in 30 Opens, and 25 of them were unsuccessful.
I think there's a lot of players who would take that percentage, though.
That's not bad.
The Open at Carnoustie in 53 with Ben Hogan there, and that obviously garnered worldwide attention, given the fact that he came back from the accident, that all that was attendant in that. That must have been an amazing experience to be a part of that Open, and in some ways in preparation for the next 3 years that would follow, maybe.
Yeah, well, we, of course, studied very carefully Ben Hogan's play and the way he went about preparing for the championship. And, of course, the execution of it and being a winner, he fulfilled his own intentions, and we were very impressed. And there were a lot of us at that age when we would be influenced by his play, and I was one. But oddly, the next year, when Royal Liverpool came up as the venue, it was preceded by the World Cup down in London in at Wentworth. And to my astonishment and everybody else's, Ben Hogan and Sam Snead was the American pair that played in the World Cup on that occasion. And they did not enter in the Open the very next week, either out of non-interest or fearsome play or something. But when I heard that they wouldn't be playing, I think my spirit soared. And I thought, well, that's going to be a great help to me if they don't turn up. And they didn't.
Pretty amazing. I mean, in the world we live in today, I know there's even discussion that's going on now. Certain players have opted out of the Open next week, and there's a lot of discussion about why people would ever do that if you had a chance to play in it. But obviously, I guess it does come up at some point. At age 24, you come into Birkdale. You must have been confident. You said you were. It was the first Open that was played at Royal Birkdale in 1954. And again, Bobby Locke was involved.
Yes.
Your first championship. He needed a three at the last, but a putt came up short. What did it feel like to get the first claret jug? What was that like, knowing how much, obviously, it would mean?
Well, it was a pretty cheeky effort by a young man. I've had a confidence that I would win that week because the previous 2 years, that remember, I'd finished second. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, natural progression, I'll be the winner next year in 1954, and it turned out to be true.
And so standing there with the claret jug.
And I had a few rebukes. Matter of fact, on the final green, I had a putt to win by two strokes from about 10 feet, I suppose. And I missed that putt, and then I went over and tapped the ball in with the back of the putter.
And kind of nonchalant,
A very old winner of the Open, Duncan, came over to me in the crowd and said, if I see you do that again, I'll kick your rear. I said, thank you, I beg your pardon. Anyway, that's part of history.
Yeah. And the next year you win at St. Andrews in 55 at the Home of Golf, and you beat a great player. One of the things that I love in terms of research and connecting people to are the names and the players that some might not be familiar with, but John Fallon of Scotland in 1955 at St. Andrews, who was a member of the Ryder Cup team and in later years, a non-playing captain of the Great Britain Ryder Cup team, John Fallon in 1955. Mm. So you go back-to-back, which was in and of itself a great accomplishment. I would think that you'd by now be settling in, given the start you'd have in the Open. Were you starting to feel like this was kind of Peter Thomson's personal playground?
Well, not quite that, but I had a confidence playing against these fellas. Mm-hmm. Because they were older than me, much older, and they'd been through the war not long before, and that, you know, I had a great reverence for people who had fought at the front and or been bomber pilots or something like that, and I felt I had an advantage with my age, and in matter of fact, it was very strange at that time of my career. For instance, Henry Cotton asked me, what makes you think you can make a living out of golf playing? I've been around golf for 50 years, and I haven't been able to make a living out of it. I have to do other things as well. So, you know, I was starting a new thing of young people aspiring to be professional golfers. That's not the golf pro at the pro shop. It's the playing the tournaments professional. Mm-hmm. And that I was one of the first people ever to do that.
Which, you know, I repeat it again, but we take so much for granted now in the age we live in and the purses and everything else. But the idea that was such a part, and I'm glad you brought up the idea of the war having ended, and there was so much going on in the world that it was a truly, truly different time. And I think so many
absolutely.
People don't understand that now.
You're absolutely right. But anyway, I'm willing to answer the questions if anyone's willing to listen.
Well, it's great. There are a lot of people who are willing to listen. In 1956, and this is a key year that I want to focus on a little bit if we can, because, as I said, next week we go to Royal Liverpool, to Hoylake. We're going to get another chance to watch one of the great golf courses and the test that it provides to the best players in the world. But in 1956, you've won back-to-back now. You go there. And if you would just kind of, you know, walk us through a little bit of the tournament. I know the first couple of rounds, the weather was a big part of the story, the horrible, horrible weather the first day and part of the second day. But you're 26 years of age, I think, at this point, and have to feel like, okay, now I'm really here.
Mm. Well, as I said, I was building up to that week and that year. And I was a bit cheeky about it, but I got the better of the weather, because this is part of the championship, of course, that you get at least one day or half a day of bad weather, like strong wind, and you survive that test, and you go on from there to perhaps lodge a very low score, and you find yourself a winner. That's in the way it came with me. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a short, quick story that when I putted out on the 18th green on the final day, I had a message from a quick message from an R&A official to say that they wanted me immediately at the clubhouse to present the trophy on a perhaps a television. I forget really why, but anyway, I didn't bring my jacket with me on that particular day, so I had to look around to find a friend of mine who with a jacket that I might use. So I saw the captain of Royal Melbourne there. He'd come to watch. And so I said, Mac, can I borrow your coat for the prize giving? He said, by all means. So those pictures you see are his jacket, not mine.
Isn't that great?
But the sequel was that a month later, when he was back in Melbourne, his wife was to send the jacket to the dry cleaner, so she was going through the pockets and she found a check for £1,000 from the RNA.
So it was still in the pocket.
It was still in the pocket, yeah.
Isn't that great? Did she just kind of look at it? Did she talk to you about, excuse me, Peter, I found something that might belong to you?
She did so, yes.
Isn't that great? I love that.
Right. Anyway, that's Bernard, lovely part of history.
I was interested to read. I'm a big Bernard Darwin fan, and if you go back and read his writing about Royal Liverpool, and I think, you know, people are going to get a taste of this again. We haven't seen Hoylake since 2006 when Tiger won. But Bernard Darwin said, this place, and this is a quote, "This place of dull and rather mean appearance is one of the most interesting and difficult courses in the world, and preeminently one which is regarded with affection by all who know it well." I thought it was a great statement by him in terms of the outward appearance. I know it's changed in the last 60 years, obviously.
Yes.
But I thought that it was an interesting, turn of the phrase by a great writer about Royal Liverpool, and because I've read other people that say the same thing. That it is.
Well, it looks dull. It looks it's flat. Most of it, mostly flat, and rather dull looking, I suppose, which is what Darwin referred to, and a bit quirky too in several places. One of them was a par three with a boundary, course boundary line across the green. It was a very peculiar hole. Mm-hmm. And a few odd ones like that. But all that's been changed, and it's modernized, and It really is as fine a test of golf for a championship as I know.
When you, your memories of Hoylake, and I know that in 2006 when Tiger won there, your style of golf, which has been described in you in the Hall of Fame bio that they wrote about you, they said that you, this is a quote, you were the thinking man's golfer with a clean, brisk game based on simple logic and a gift for reducing things to their simplest essentials. And when I read it, I thought, now, I was young when you won, certainly in the 50s. I was born in 1950 and was not interested in the game. But when I look back at video and when I read and do the things that I like doing, it seems that just the outward appearance of your game, and certainly everything I've read, was that that was kind of a hallmark of your game. I was wondering how you felt. And you were there in 2006. I know the 50th anniversary of your victory. There was a presentation. You must have been, or were you, as impressed as the rest of the world was with the style of golf that Tiger played in 2006 and the clean, meticulous way that he went about kind of dissecting Hoylake.
Yeah, I think the course had a lot to do with his win, because it wasn't possible for him to attempt those massive, mighty drives he used to hit that a few always ended up in the trees somewhere, and or the rough. So he was forced to use four irons and number three irons off the tee and keep himself in play. And that truthfully is the way I always played anyway. People did it before Tiger. That's laying up, as they call it, on the tee shots.
Right.
And going for the greens from a further way out. I hope that's not too complicated.
No, of course it makes
but
total
anyway,
sense.
Anyway, I'm a great admirer of his golf when he plays well. It's great.
Well, obviously the world is interested to see what kind of game he brings when he comes next week. I was interested to read that the course is only playing a little over 7,300 yards. Which in those conditions, we'll see what they'll be. But it's not that. It's only 370 yards longer than it was a long time ago. I mean, it's still going to be a strategic course.
Well, they don't have any extra land to use. That's the reason for that.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'd love to go extend it a bit longer, but there's no territory to do it.
Right. But it will still test those players, the green complexes.
Of course it will, especially if the wind blows. We don't want rain, but we certainly want wind.
We're hoping for some wind, aren't we, Peter?
Yeah, we are, so. Well, it was nice to talk to you.
Well, it was wonderful to talk to you, and thank you for sharing the memories. And it's been a great honor, and we'll think of you next week as we watch Hoylake and all the great accomplishments you've had. Thanks again for being with us here.
You're welcome.
Okay,
bye.
Peter. There goes Peter Thompson, and again, you could spend hours talking to this gentleman. I mean, just not only an amazing career in the game, but outside of the game, a great golf course architect, a lover of opera. I was stunned to read all the different things that Peter Thompson has done by way of living a wonderful, wonderful life, not just in the game, but outside the game. And obviously, we're grateful for his time all the way from Australia. Glad you've been with us here on Golf Connections for Open Championship Month. I'm Mitch Lawrence. Golf Connections is produced and broadcast by the Zeus Radio Network for thegolfdirector.com. So long, everybody. Thanks again to Peter Thompson.